If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
So this isn't exactly investment advice, but I think taking that order, protection, savings, and lastly, growth, gives you the right foundation upon which to access the best investments out there available to families.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jared Williams is the leading expert on investing for cash flow using biblical and non-Wall Street investments. He has served hundreds of stewardship-minded Christians from around the world to enhance their wealth, protect their families, increase their cash flow, and impact others through investing. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. Happy to be on.
Oh, man, the pleasure is mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on. Where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep that short for a shorter show. It's a fairly long story, to be honest. So, man, I didn't start in the finance world at all. Started in the social work world. The idea was to be a foreign missionary. That was the career plan for a long time. And so social work, you learn how to help people. Abroad, you can use it anywhere. So that was the idea. But I ended up hating working in social work and, planned to go to seminary. That never ended up happening. You know, got married, started having children, and, you know, life just kind of went on. And so it was when we were pregnant with my first daughter and realizing, hey, we wanted my wife to be able to stay home and we're not going to make it on a, bachelor level social work salary. So we're going to have to figure something else out. And so a friend called me up out of the blue, said, hey, you're a big financial nerd. You read lots of these books. So I'd like your opinion on this. He said it nicer than that, but that's what he meant. And introduced me to a company that sold, term life insurance, not exactly door to door, but, you know, through a multi-level marketing type of structure. So I did some research, joined up with them. It was a great learning experience, certainly not the long-term model that I wanted to pursue, but a good learning experience. And it did get me into the financial industry. And so I'll fast forward several years later, I met a guy at our church's Christmas party and we were having a what do you do conversation. And he shared with me this idea of what he called biblically responsible investing. And he had formed a company around that about 15 years prior at that time. So essentially they had built mutual funds that screened out companies that supported or even profited from things just that, you know, that Christian investors probably would not want to support and profit. Things like abortion, pornography, addiction, things like that, that were fairly common, rampant in, you know, the larger stock market companies that most everyone is invested in. So that was a pretty compelling reason to dive deeper and get into the investment realm. And so I ended up getting a license as an investment advisor, found a firm out of California that I worked with for several years, and just began learning that industry. And the more that I learned, the more that I saw major problems with the what I call the typical financial approach. That things just don't work out the way that you think they're going to, the way that they look like they're going to on compound interest calculators. And just, you know, life doesn't go as planned. And the more that I met with clients, and I ended up inheriting like 95 clients at one point, which was very unheard of. But it gave me this great opportunity to talk with, you know, 90-something families within about a six-month period of time, and most of whom were retired. And so I got to hear all their backstory and all of what was good and what went bad, and really started seeing lots of common themes in that. And so, you know, I really began trying to look for solutions. I had identified these problems and I looked for solutions and found that, you know, off Wall Street investments solved a lot of, not all of, but a lot of the problems that these just average families were facing. And so the last several years has been me figuring out as a licensed investment advisor, how can I help the clients that I serve, you know, find investments outside of Wall Street that work, that are, you know, legal for them, way of doing it in a way that I can be compensated. And so as of this recording, I am in the process of starting a company that will create diversified funds, primarily with real estate, although there may be some other non-real estate investments inside of that as well. And I think there's several different pros to that sort of approach. So that is the short version of a long story for sure, Sam.
No, I like that. I like that a lot because you have seen both sides of really this industry and have decided to take your business in a different direction. Is that a fair analysis?
Absolutely. Yep.
Fantastic. So let's talk about that fund then. Okay. I mean, is it a fund that you're starting?
Yeah. So just real quick, I can't talk in great detail about the fund, but I can definitely talk about the business model, the plan for all the funds in the future. So we can talk about funds. We can talk about them in generalities for sure. But yeah, go ahead and ask your questions.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's do just that. Like what does that look like starting one? What does that look like for, you know, types of assets that a fund might like this might want to look at? I mean, how do you find operators? How do you find investments? How do you make sure they fit? I mean,
yeah,
just walk us creation all the way to, you know, inking deals with other sponsors.
Yeah, we don't have nearly enough time to go through all of that. It has been the most challenging project I've ever undertaken in my career by far. An enormous learning curve for sure. So, you know, I've gained knowledge and experience in a number of different real estate assets, and multifamily investing has really jumped out as one of my very favorites for a variety of reasons, which I'm sure you've covered a lot in other episodes as well. So we won't dive into that. But there was a couple of problems that I found for my investors investing in direct syndications. And so that's what I'm trying to solve. And I think that'll help paint the picture of the fund and some of the pros and cons there. So the two problems that I found were, I love the asset class. You know, most of the time they have a $50,000, $100,000 minimum. That's pretty decent. That's pretty steep for, you know, average families, especially younger, you know, families getting started. You know, I certainly have clients who can invest into a whole bunch of those, but I also have families who they could do one or two at most. And so it's difficult to be, you know, diversified there. And while, again, I think it's a great asset class, I think you can really manage risk a lot. We never know what's going to happen. You know, things go unexpected from time to time. And so I didn't like the lack of diversification that was available, especially to this group, you know, this younger, smaller group of investors. The other thing that was a challenge for everyone across the board was just the logistics of getting into them. You know, most of my clients are busy professionals. They've got busy jobs, busy businesses. They've got families. I mean, time is limited for sure. And so the way it typically works, you know, when a deal is available from a syndicator, you know, they send out an email or a text blast that goes out to, hopefully, if they got a good list, hundreds of people. And, you know, the good ones that I've seen, and, you know, people take time to get there, but I've frequently seen them fill up in 24 hours or less. So you got to be ready to pull that trigger. You got to be looking for those emails and ready to pull the trigger. Obviously, you still have time to do the due diligence and make sure that you want to invest. But even that, it should take a good amount of time. You should take several hours at least to do the vetting and due diligence on these deals. And you may have 2 weeks to do that. You might be on vacation when it comes out. You know, so I've had lots of investors who've missed out on deals just because of that process. And so I think the fund allows me to do that myself. So, you know, I can't really do that for investment clients, you know, in that regard. But if they're investing in my fund, then they can take more time to understand what our strategies and all of it is. And then when those deals come out, you know, I do have the time because it's my full-time career, you know, to pull the trigger quickly, to do that due diligence, to understand what I'm looking at and make those decisions. And then obviously with a fund, you know, rather than investing in a single syndication, where you'd be investing in hopefully five, you know, or even more syndications all at once. And so if something goes unexpectedly with one of them, it has a fairly small impact on the returns and is a great way to get a majority of the returns you'd expect from a single syndication at a fraction of the risk. And so most of the families that I've talked to have felt like that was a very valuable trade-off.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to rehash the pain points there that you are solving, one is the, you know, the speed of execution.
Yeah.
In that a lot of times, like you said, busy families don't have, and it does take time. I mean, I think that's what I think about the last deal we just did and the amount of time I spent on the phone, either with a group of five to six of the investors coming on board or however it worked out. But I mean, gosh, by the time we got, you know, had all the calls, everybody was on board, and then we got through paperwork, and then there was a couple pages because some guy was an IRA and one guy was this. And in the end, it's like, my gosh, like each of these investors probably spent 3 to 5 hours by the time they read through the documents, got everything inked, everything back and forth, signs, you know, just like, so for you, you can cut all that out. So
yeah,
that's number one. What was the second one there? I'm trying to rehash it here and I can't think of the second point.
Yeah, and I think it's the bigger one. It's the reducing the risk, I guess, is the advantage or the pro side of describing that.
Exactly. That is super cool. Let's move into how a fund like this would vet its operators and how do you find quality operators that kind of meet your criteria?
Yeah, that's a great question. And still a work in progress, to be honest with you. I think that comes through having lots of conversations with operators. So having lots of conversations with the same operator and lots of conversations with different operators. And, you know, there's a few things that I'm looking for. There are some kind of firm criteria. You know, I want them to be experienced. You know, we're as a fund, you know, where I'm managing other people's money, I'm not going to invest in their first deal, you know, and probably not their second. So there needs to be experience, ideally, even if it isn't the lead sponsor, someone in that, you know, sponsorship team has taken one or more projects full cycle, you know, to completion, has gone through the refinance, potentially the selling process a few times. So that would be not a hard and fast rule, but something very desirable and that we would want to see in an operator. And all other things being equal, we'd obviously go with someone with more experience. And it just takes time for operators to get there, unfortunately, you know, just the way it is. And it'll take time for me to build up, you know, experience in my role as the fund manager as well. So that can't be accelerated, but it can be partnered. And so that's a good way to solve the problem. We're also looking at, you know, what markets are they investing in? Are they all over the country, or do they have, you know, one or two niche markets that they really understand well, have similar properties there? You know, what kinds of problems have they had? Because everyone's going to have problems. So have they weathered some storms? Have they had to come up with creative solutions to setbacks? And what does that look like? Those are a few things on the operator side. There's probably more. I don't have a list in front of me. I do have a list, but it's not in front of me. And then just gut. You know, like I've talked with some people that I just didn't click with. I probably don't want to spend hours on the phone with them. I don't want to, you know, be negotiating things or helping solve problems. And so they would be, you know, they would likely be excluded. Others that I've loved their mission. I've loved, you know, the creativity I've seen out of it. I've loved hearing the stories and how they treat different properties differently, which shows me they really have a strategic understanding of what they're doing. So really the only way to understand those things is through having lots of conversation. And I do have the time. I make the time to do that. So that's how I vet the operators. Then obviously we look at markets, properties, and, you know, deal structure itself are the other three big components that we're looking at. And before we would, you know, make an investment.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So at this point, you've got operators sending deals to you saying, hey, what do you think about this? Or are you still just in the dating phase of, hey guys, let's just sit down and just chat about who you are and what type of deals you might like?
Yeah. So there's some operators that are definitely on the bench. I mean, there's operators that when we get the fund open and it's, and you know, this first one isn't open yet, but when that is completed and we've raised the capital and we're ready, there are operators that I have vetted and feel very comfortable investing with. But that's always an ongoing process. You know, I never know what deal flow is going to look like for a certain operator. So I would like to have a deep bench, so to speak, of operators to go to. And that there's a variety of benefits to that. So I'm still, you know, dating some for sure. And some we've gone on to where, you know, we would do some deals together.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I just wonder how, you know, for me, the hard thing would be having the right operator, but then maybe the wrong deal. Mm-hmm. Saying, hey guys, you know, this one isn't for us. I've run across that before. And it's always a hard conversation because everybody wants to know why. Like, why isn't this the right deal for you? Well, you know, here's a few reasons why. And then you might end up souring some relationships because they're like, well, all right, well, I'm not going to send them to you know, Sam anymore because he's saying no. So I guess have you hit that stage yet where you're saying no to things guys are sending you?
Behind the scenes, yes. And just to be clear, I'm not in the, what sounds like you're describing, and I may be misunderstanding, but what it sounds like you're describing is kind of the co-sponsor model where they may be coming to me to raise a majority of capital. And depending on how big the deal is, we could raise, you know, a significant portion of it, but I would actually be investing as the fund, as a limited investor. And so we wouldn't be a co-sponsor. We certainly wouldn't be, you know, who they're relying on to raise most of the capital. Now they might hope we can bring a good chunk of it and it would hurt not to. But no, I mean, I would do that. For instance, I mean, there's an operator that I really like, but he sent out a deal recently and it was too early for the fund, but you know, the upcoming fund, you know, it was a little bit out of the wheelhouse. It was a new development that they were doing. And I think that was a newer project for him. And while it probably was a good investment, it doesn't fit what we're trying to do. You know, it wasn't cash flowing for a couple of years. And you know, that's just a different strategy and not what my fund is looking for. At least not this first one. Now down the road, we may do funds where that'd be a great fit. So it really just has to be a fit, you know, conversation. And they may come to me when we've already deployed all our capital. And so we would have invested, but we're out of money, you know, in this fund, so to speak. So I've made it clear to operators, we'll invest where we can, but not to, you know, bank on me to be their primary capital raiser.
Sure. No, and I was thinking more, I was just thinking of you investing on the limited partnership side, not coming in as a partner, but coming in as, you know, but even so, like you said, you may be able to present, depending on what the size of the fund is, a large portion of the limited partnership.
Yeah.
Is there a percentage that you guys say will be a maximum that you will put into any one deal? Like, would you say, hey, you know, even though it might be a $5 million raise, you guys will be no more than a million of it? Or have you thought through that?
Some. I've had bigger fish to fry. And so that hasn't been, I got to figure that piece out yet. So not yet. I don't think that we would ever be in a position where we would, you know, be a controlling investor, have, you know, more than half of it or something. That kind of deal would probably be too small for what we're trying to do. And rather than writing massive checks, I would prefer to further diversify. So there's kind of a sweet spot there. But if we raised more than expected and I could start writing, you know, multiple seven-figure checks out of the fund, I would probably add more syndications rather than increasing my investment size. That just further benefits the investor and keeps us out of that like majority investor space.
Right. Hey, thank you, Jared, for sharing so much information on kind of your experience up to this point in forming the fund, the types of things you guys are looking for. And yeah, all the best to you as you get that fund launched. I look forward to seeing where that goes. Let's go a little different direction with this. Are there some things as you kind of review your financial services career, are there some things you wish you would have done differently or maybe that you would do differently if you could?
No, I have no idea how things would be going now if I had done things differently. Now, you know, I wish I knew now what, you know, I wish I'd known years ago what I know now. You know, I would have done things faster. But at the same time, it's all taken time to learn and all the experiences along the way. I can look back and see multiple, you know, building blocks along the way that had I not gone through this experience, you know, I wouldn't know what I know now. Had I not been part of a broker dealer at one point, I wouldn't know how much I don't want to be part of a broker dealer, you know, at this point. Had I not done something, not made any, you know, big mistakes, but recommended investments that I probably wouldn't recommend today, you know, to clients, I wouldn't have seen the, you know, the aftermath of that. Not that anyone's lost money, but what I mean is, so that could sound really scary. So what I mean is, you know, years ago, helping clients invest in annuities and things that have done exactly what they're supposed to do, but not what I would do today. I think there's much better solutions is what I'm referring to there. You know, I wouldn't have done those things. So, but had I not, I wouldn't have the understanding that I have today. And I don't know that I would have ended up where I'm at.
Right.
So I know that's not a helpful answer to like creating, you know, content for the podcast, but.
No, it absolutely is. It brings a positive spin, you know, to that question, because a lot of times, you know, at least for me, I can go back and be like, oh yeah, if I hadn't done this, I could have, you know, saved myself a ton of money and shaved a year.
Yeah,
off of my learning.
Absolutely.
But, you know, good for you, you know, for viewing it through the lens of, you know, these were all positive experiences getting you to where you are today. I do have one just nuanced question. You said you used to work for a broker dealer, but now you don't.
Yeah.
So you are still a registered investment advisor. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm still an investment advisor. And so there's a number of capacities you can be, you know, in the financial services industry. So right. An investment advisor, but no longer like a registered rep with a broker dealer and, you know, doing any of that kind of stuff.
Right. So I'm learning here because I know there's technical jargon, but an RIA is, I thought they always worked under a broker dealer.
No. So I think I can explain this quickly. Okay. A broker dealer is in the business of selling securities.
Sure.
So whether that's a mutual fund, an annuity, a stock, a bond or whatever, it's selling securities. They typically do that by commission.
Yep.
Investment advisors are in the business of selling essentially investment advice, which could be in the form of portfolio management or financial planning or advising on a specific investment. And so they're charging fees directly to investors, which is a very different model and even entirely different governing. You know, there's the Securities Act, which governs broker dealers, and the Investment Act or Investment Advisors Act, rather, you know, that governs investment advisors. So there are many people out there who are both, you know, who are investment advisors and they're part of a broker dealer. And then there are some who are, you know, one or the other. And just for a variety of reasons, I really prefer the investment advisor side of things.
Gotcha. Okay. Hey, that's interesting. I learned something new today. Hey, Jared, let's jump here into the final four. This is question number one. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
To an aspiring investor. We work off the model, when I'm working with families, we work off the model of protection, savings, growth, and in that order. And most families I see do that the opposite. I mean, they may have their, you know, home and auto insurance and things like that, health insurance obviously first, but they typically invest first through their 401k or IRA. They'll get that going. Then they'll start working on savings and debt and things like that. And you know, then lastly, they may come around and really shore up some of the protection pieces, although often that doesn't even get done. That is definitely the wrong way to approach it, in my opinion. I think we should begin with protection, you know, avoiding or managing those catastrophic risks that, regardless of how well we've invested, can destroy the whole house, so to speak. Then we can save. And with saving, not only do we have emergency funds and can weather those storms, but you got to have, like we talked about, you need 50K, 100K, you know, sometimes to get into some of the better investment opportunities out there. So you got to save first to get there. And if you lock it all up in 401ks, it can be really difficult, not impossible, but it can be difficult to get it back out and have some of those better investments. So this isn't exactly investment advice, but I think taking that order, protection, savings, and lastly, growth, gives you the right foundation upon which to access the best investments out there available to families.
Right. No, that's great. That is great. Question number two is this: when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Man, just always learning and out being willing to ask questions, to schedule phone calls to people and ask lots and lots of questions. And I ask the same question to lots of people because sometimes I get different answers. And then I got to go figure out who's right. And that's hard. But that has been the name of the game for years, has just been being really curious, asking lots of questions. Don't accept the first answer. No matter, even if it's attorney, like they'll tell me something, I'll go read it in the law. And sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. And I want to see it in black and white and understand it the best I can.
Right. No, that's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Oh, man. I think making this type of education and even investment opportunities available to average families is extremely valuable to those families. And we could have a whole other conversation about the impact that that is created by making, you know, private direct investments into real estate and multifamily and things of that nature and on all the people who are served. This is absolutely, or it can be, and it should be a win-win investment, for lack of a better term, for everybody involved.
Sure. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Because you're right. The small guy oftentimes does get left out, especially on these bigger deals. And those are the ones where a lot of times the largest wealth is created. So, good for you for doing that. Jared, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, the best way is to go to biblicalwealthsolutions.com. That's the name of the company. I'm not sure if we've mentioned that. Biblicalwealthsolutions.com. I also host the Biblical Wealth Podcast. And so you can find that in any podcast app. That's the best way to get in touch with me. I also have a course I just recently released called Creating Compounding Cash Flow with Multifamily Investing. I made up that term. Someone else might have used it. I have no idea, but I thought it was the best fitting term. So it's a free course, just learning a lot of the basics about investing in multifamily. And Sam, I can send you a link to include in the show notes for that.
That would be awesome. Jared, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.